Stand by while NCLA cuts through the noise to signal abuse of administrative power. This is Administrative Static with Mark Chenoweth and John Vecchione.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here. John Vecchione led our last couple of segments. And this segment, I wanted to interview one of our colleagues here at the New Civil Liberties Alliance, Adi Dinar. Adi is a litigation counsel here at the NCLA, and he has been spearheading the effort that we have had defending the Federalist and the head honcho, I guess you would say, Adi, at the Federalist, Ben Domenech. He's his editor-in-chief, his title?
Yes, he's the publisher of the Federalist.
The publisher, okay, the publisher of the Federalist. Over the charges that the National Labor Relations Board have brought against him for unfair labor practices. And we've talked about this on the show before, so I'll give just briefly what's happened here for any new listeners or folks who haven't heard previous podcasts on this topic. But essentially what happened is a random person on the internet saw a tweet that Ben Domenech had sent out from his personal Twitter account in jest, saying that speaking to a walkout that had occurred at Vox, which was another sort of left of center website where the staff had walked out, and Domenech said, sent something to his staff along the lines of, the first one of you who tries that here, I'll send you back to the salt mines. He was joking. The staff took it as a joke, and somebody on the internet, on the another Twitter user, did not, and filed unfair labor practice charges at the NLRB, and literally made a federal case out of this joke tweet of Ben's. And so NCLA stepped in to defend the Federalist, to defend Ben Domenech, and Adi has been, as I say, spearheading that effort. And Adi, I wanted to have you on the show this week. And first of all, welcome to the show. But I wanted to have you on the show this week because the government just filed its response to NCLA's brief in the Third Circuit. And I wanted to find out sort of what the government said and why they're wrong.
Thanks, Mark. And thanks for having me. So the government essentially is trivializing the First Amendment. And I'll start there because I think that's the first thing that comes to people's minds when they see a tweet that's made in jest. And if the government is trying to silence that speech, then the first thing that occurs to ordinary people would be the First Amendment protections that everyone enjoys. The NLRB's filing is curious because they are essentially trying to ask the Third Circuit to rule that the NLRB can make the First Amendment optional. And what I mean by that is the NLRB does not want to look into the context in which the speech occurred. The NLRB does not care about how the employees understood the tweet. It does not care about how exchanges on Twitter, speech on Twitter occurs in general. They don't want to care about, they don't want to know if this was directed at the employees or at the public at large. They do not want to look at any of that. Instead, they just want to look at the tweet and say it's an unfair labor practice. And I have several issues with that because I'm trying to think of Abraham Maslow, who is a prominent psychologist, American psychologist, who is known for Maslow's hammer. He said in his popular statement, to one with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And to the NLRB, everything looks like an unfair labor practice, even a Twitter joke. And every random Twitter person looks like an oppressed employee. And that can't be right. You should allow, government should not interfere when there is some kind of, government should not interfere when people are trying to have an honest discussion and debate over social media.
So why does the government think, Adi, that the First Amendment doesn't protect the speech that is in play here? What is it about the National Labor Relations Act or the NLRB's power that they think overcomes the First Amendment protections that you're talking about?
So I think the NLRB, from its filing, is suggesting that anytime someone speaks about something that could remotely be construed as touching labor relations, then that is an unfair labor practice. Employers just can't talk about labor issues, especially in public fora. And that doesn't seem right, because employers and supervisors of employers can usually speak about, give their opinions about labor issues. They can truthfully speak about the repercussions or consequences of what would happen if, say, there's a salary increase or a salary decrease, or there's changes in health benefits or so forth. So none of that speech is prescribable by the National Labor Relations Board. So why is this?
Well, it seems to me particularly strange that you would prescribe the speech of a newspaper, or, I mean, in this case, the Federalist isn't literally a newspaper, but it's the modern equivalent. It's an online kind of newspaper. That's what they do, right? They write articles, they publish opinion pieces. To tell the publisher of a paper, hey, you can't share opinions on things that touch on, on labor practices, that seems very antithetical to the First Amendment to me.
That's right, Mark, and that is a crucial point. That one of the crucial points that the NLRB is simply ignoring in this case. When we talk of media publications like the Federalist, they usually comment on current controversial topics, and this just happened to be one of the controversial topics that everyone was talking about in June of 2019, and that simply is not speech that the NLRB can attack using the National Labor Relations Act.
So I know that there's another issue in this case having to do with the person who filed the charges against the Federalist. NCLA has taken the position that under the National Labor Relations Act, only a person who is aggrieved by the unfair labor practice can bring a charge. And we have said here that this random person on the internet or on Twitter who saw Ben's tweet, they're not aggrieved in the statutory sense, and therefore shouldn't be able to bring a charge in the first place, thus depriving the NLRB of jurisdiction here. What is the government saying in its response brief on this jurisdictional point?
So the government is trying to downplay the jurisdictional point. Their essential argument is any person can file an unfair labor practice charge. And that comes from the NLRB's own regulations, and we make several jurisdictional as well as jurisdictional arguments, as well as arguments saying that the court should not defer to the NLRB's interpretation of its own regulations. As our listeners would know, Kaiser versus Wilkie, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from last year, 2 years ago now, was a decision in which the U.S. Supreme Court said that you have to empty the legal toolkit as a judge before you can defer to the interpretation offered by a federal agency. And here, the NLRB is trying to convert some random person on the internet into a person who can confer authority on the board to prosecute these companies. And that can't be right.
Well, if anybody could bring an unfair labor practice charge, then presumably an employee at the NLRB could be the person who would, you know, in their personal capacity, create a charge or bring a charge or fill out the appropriate paperwork. And I just, it seems to me like the NLRB is trying to bootstrap it additional enforcement authority by broadening the scope of who can bring these charges beyond what Congress intended. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me that if you're an employee and you're aggrieved by something your employer says, that you could bring a charge. Or if you're a union who wants to represent those employees, you could bring a charge. At least if, you know, if there's at least maybe one employee at the, you know, at the employer who's been talking to you. So there's some privity with the employees, or even like a former employee, I could imagine, or maybe even a family member. But to throw it open to the world and say anybody can bring an unfair labor practice charge, doesn't that open the door to sort of strategic behavior by competitors of the Federalist in this case, or whoever else might your competition be?
Absolutely. I mean, it opens up employers to massive liability because the NLRB, as you said, can bootstrap, can kind of, you know, file a complaint with itself, if you will, try to go after employers that way. And the problem with that is Congress did not give the board that authority. Congress said that only aggrieved people can file these charges. And, you know, some of the typical aggrieved people that we see are employees, there are significant others, you know, maybe a union, a collective bargaining representative. What is not right is to allow random people to confer this investigatory and prosecutorial authority on the board.
And then the last issue in the case has to do with venue. Obviously, the Federalist is based in the Washington, D.C. Area, and I think they have employees in a few different places around the country who work remotely. But they're not in New York City, and yet that's where the NLRB, which is also based in D.C., decided to bring these charges. I'll just say as an initial matter, when the NLRB based in D.C. decides to go after the Federalist based in D.C. and they decide to do it in New York City, that sets off some alarm bells for me that they're up to no good. But what is we only have about 45 seconds left here, Adi, but tell me what's going on with the what the government said on venue and what your response is to that.
So the government's argument is internet happens everywhere and the NLRB is everywhere in the United States, so we can go wherever we want. And that's a huge issue because that's just imagine the industry shattering implications of that. I mean, the NLRB could bring a Hawaii corporation into their Vermont office just because someone in Florida complained about it. And we know from just traditional personal jurisdiction cases that that's not right.
Well, that's terrific, Adi. Thank you so much for sharing with us today what's been going on in this case. Look forward to your oral argument at the Third Circuit. I'm sure we'll have you back again to keep our listeners up to speed on what's been happening in this case.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth here. And as Vec alluded to earlier, we are going to be talking about birds in this last segment today, particularly something called the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, MBTA. This is a treaty that was signed in 1918 between the United States, right in the middle of World War I, apparently, between the United States and the United Kingdom or Great Britain. And the reason why is because the treaty was really between the U.S. and Canada, but at that time, Canada was, I suppose, a protectorate of the United Kingdom or wasn't independent yet. And so the treaty is between the Great Britain and the United States, although Canada has taken that over. And what the treaty does is it protects 1,000 different species of migratory birds that migrate between. I don't know that they all migrate between the United States and Canada, but they're either migrate between or they migrate in Canada or in the United States. And what the treaty does is it agrees that both countries will protect those migratory birds from being deliberately killed. So there are certain kinds of birds that are game birds that have hunting permits and those kinds of things around them. You might think about turkey, or well, I guess turkeys probably aren't migratory, but maybe Canadian geese would be the prototypical example of a bird that you are allowed to hunt, that there are hunting permits and so forth. There are certain kinds of ducks that you can hunt as well, but there are all kinds of migratory birds that are off limits. You are not allowed to kill these. And this happened in part, or this treaty went into effect in part because of the destruction of many bird species about 100 years ago, including several populations were decimated, and then the passenger pigeon went extinct as a result of overhunting. And so there was a movement to protect these birds. And I should hasten to add that the New Civil Liberties Alliance, we're not anti-Byrd. We're not, we don't want to see a return to the days when entire populations of birds were hunted to extinction. That's not what this case is about. Well, I say case, it's not a case yet. It's a position that the Department of Interior has taken, particularly the Fish and Wildlife Service has taken with respect to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Now, the Treaty Act is the piece of legislation that Congress passed in order to implement the Migratory Bird Treaty that I was referring to. And the particular problem that has happened, and it's not brand new, this is something that has the last few administrations have been going back and forth on. But the question is, what is the meaning of the word take in the statute and in the treaty? Because what is prohibited under the treaty, there's a lot of things that are prohibited under the treaty, and they all have to do with like killing, as I mentioned, the bird, disturbing the nest, stealing the eggs. There are a lot of things about the birds and the nests and the eggs that are all prohibited under the language of this act. But in all of the cases, whatever the verbiage is in there, or whatever the particular wording that's used, it all goes to directly impacting the bird, right? So if you are directly killing the bird, that's a problem. If you're directly stealing the eggs, that's a problem. If you're disturbing the nest, that's a problem. Well, what about if you are doing some other conduct that doesn't really, isn't really aimed at the birds at all? Suppose that you own a windmill and that the blades of that windmill are, just by experience and operation, that some number of birds are going to fly into the windmill in the course of a given year. Is that prohibited? Are you now in violation if your windmill strikes a bird? If you're driving down the interstate in North Dakota and a migratory bird flies into your windshield, have you now committed an offense underneath the statute? And by the way, the reason this matters is there are criminal penalties under this statute. This is a serious crime to be intentionally disturbing these birds or killing these birds. And what NCLA is concerned about in what the Biden administration is doing, what the Fish and Wildlife Service is doing, is they are expanding what is prohibited by the statute. So what Congress prohibited was all of these direct activities, and the agency has expanded the word take to include this concept of incidental take, meaning that if you, in the course of doing something else, you take or kill a bird, then you are guilty, just as guilty as someone or just as criminally culpable as somebody who did it deliberately. The problem is, from NCLA's perspective, that's not what the statute says. The statute and the treaty, they don't say anything about incidental take. That phrase is not in the law. And so we have a concern when an agency, in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service, makes something criminal that Congress did not make criminal. So this is the same problem that we have, for example, in our bump stock cases, where the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, has outlawed bump stocks, even though Congress never did so. And when you have administrative agencies and a branch of the administrative state making something criminal, in the case of bump stocks, they made 500,000 people who had purchased these things legally into felons as a result of that conduct. And here, the Fish and Wildlife Service is wanting to do the same thing. They're wanting to turn everybody who incidentally takes birds into a felon under federal law, as criminally culpable for killing these birds. But that's not what the treaty is about. That's not what the language of the statute says. And if Congress wants to send people to jail or have criminal fines for them for incidental take, then Congress needs to be the one that passes that law. That can't be something that the Fish and Wildlife Service or the Department of Interior comes up with on its own as the result of reinterpreting the statute or sort of really adding to the statute that Congress itself passed. And you might think, well, how does this affect me? Well, really where this goes to is there's been, at least this was true in the Obama administration, and I suspect that it will be true in the Biden administration as well. What they're saying is, well, don't worry, you can trust us. We'll make this criminal, and then we'll use our prosecutorial discretion in order to decide who is actually going to be prosecuted under this statute. Well, I don't know about you, but I'm not big on trusting the prosecutorial discretion of the government to say, hey, even though we're going to say that something that you're doing, and in this case, something you've done accidentally, you've driven down the highway and you've hit a bird with your car, and now you've, under their definition at least, now you've violated the law. But don't worry, you can trust us. We're not going to come after you. We'll use prosecutorial discretion. Well, you know, I don't trust that. One of the reasons I don't trust it is if you look at the record of who the agencies have gone after, well, it's almost exclusively oil companies, right? If you look at the cases that have been brought in federal court for incidental take or for take, in almost all the cases, it's examples where a bird has gotten caught up in some oil equipment, or a bird has flown into a pit of some kind that was on the property where some oil drilling was taking place. That is what this is all about. It's about trying to raise the cost of some of the oil drilling that's happening in North Dakota and elsewhere. It's about making criminal liability for folks who are engaged in that particular industry. And what you don't see is lawsuits brought against the wind energy industry for incidental strikes of birds, even though the birds that are killed by windmills tend to be very majestic birds, right? These are raptors in many cases that we're finding out are being killed by the hundreds as the number of windmills erected in the United States increases. And it's not too surprising because they try to put windmills up in windy areas, and the birds like to fly in windy areas as well. And so windmills and raptors are not a good combination. And so you're seeing a lot of bird deaths as a result of the windmills. And if Congress wants to make that illegal, they can. If Congress wants to stop subsidizing wind energy, it can do that as well. We would see fewer windmills and fewer bird strikes. But if Congress doesn't want to do that, then what we can't have is a situation where the Fish and Wildlife Service decides, hey, we're going to make this incidental take a crime, and then we're going to go after one industry, but not after another industry. In this case, we're going to go after the oil and gas industry for any incidental take of birds under the MBTA that happen in that industry, but we're not going to prosecute any of the wind energy companies that might incidentally take a bird as a result of either flying into a windmill or being struck by a spinning blade. Because when these, I think what happens, I'm not an expert in this area, but I think what happens is when these windmills are going fast enough, you can't necessarily see the blade of the windmill. And so when the bird is flying in, you know, they get struck, and it's like your kid sticking their finger into the fan or something. That's not going to end well for that bird. And so, you know, my point is not that the government should be prosecuting oil companies and wind energy companies, although if this is turned into a crime, I do think that that any enforcement actions ought to be done even-handedly. But the problem is that this shouldn't be a crime at all unless and until Congress acts. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act did not make this a crime. From 1918 until 1973, no one thought that incidental take was a crime. But in the Endangered Species Act of 1973, which is a different law, incidental take is a concept that was put into that law. And then it's been imported since then by some administrations as applying in the Migratory Bird Treaty Act context as well, even though that statute and that treaty do not refer to incidental take. Only the Endangered Species Act does. So I think that concept has been inappropriately taken over. If Congress wants to extend the Migratory Bird Treaty Act to cover incidental take, Congress needs to act. It can't be the Department of Interior or the Fish and Wildlife Service that creates new criminal law and that asks the rest of us to trust to prosecutorial discretion and trust the government not to to go after, not to target particular individuals for criminality under the MBTA. Again, we love birds at the NCLA, but that's why we filed these comments with the Fish and Wildlife Service. head to nclalegal.org to learn more about this or any of NCLA's other cases, and we'll see you back next week.